Okay, no mission creep today, just reflection. So from today, I thought today's talks were wonderful. So the things that came to mind is work is already cultural influence. To engage in work is to be influencing culture, so we're already in that business. And it's also cross-cultural. Right? The workplaces are not Christian places, so we're already doing cross-cultural mission. And it seems to me like workplaces are a lot like Athens. They're full of idols. And we are greatly distressed, as Paul was, by what we see in the workplace: corruption, deceptive marketing, worker exploitation, financial short-termism, and consumerism. So cultural influence is a workplace question. As it happens, the Theology of Work Project has a commentary on this section on today's readings, Bible readings. I don't want to read the whole thing to you, but I want to read an excerpt. In our workplaces, we need to be observant, as Paul was observant. We can find many good practices in our schools, businesses, governments, and other workplaces, even though they do not arise within the Christian community. If we are truly observant, we see that even those unaware or scornful of Christ are nonetheless made in the image of God. Like Paul, we could cooperate with them rather than try to discredit them. We can work with non-believers to improve labor and management relationships, improve customer service, do better research and development, achieve corporate and civic governance better, do public education, and in other fields. We ought to make use of skills and insights developed in universities, corporations, nonprofits, and other places. Our role is not to condemn others' work, but to deepen it and show that their work proves that he is not far from each one of us. So imagine the difference between saying, because you don't know Christ, all your work is wrong, versus because I do know Christ, I think I can appreciate your work, maybe even more than you appreciate your work. I'm sorry, that was a scrolled a part that is below what you see here. So that raised the question for me, do we hijack or do we engage in culture? And it seems to me that in terms of media, to hijack culture would be to try to push Christian message through books, movies, and songs in the mainstream media. If all we wanted to do is just kind of get more Christian message out there. But to actually engage culture would be to do something like write an appreciative movie review or bring a Christian perspective to the table the way Paul brought a Christian perspective to the Areopagus. And a great positive example of that to me is Andy Crouch. I didn't know he was going to be the speaker this morning when I put this in. But he writes letters to the Wall Street Journal, and I'm sure other papers. Well, he'll engage a movie or a topic that's been in the events, and he'll appreciate the movie on its own terms. And then he'll add a Christian perspective in. And he talks about how to do that in his book, Making Culture, which I highly recommend. Well, what about in politics? To hijack culture, I think, is just to try to get legislation passed advancing Christian interests and issues. And I regret that a lot of evangelical engagement in politics seems, in my view, to be kind of trying to hijack politics. Whereas engaging it would be doing something, an example would be researching and developing and educating Christians about political issues using real-world analysis. And I think a negative example is right now in the United States House of Representatives, there's a U.S. farm bill that addresses poverty. The Senate has passed it. It's in the House of Representatives now. And I just wonder how many Christians know that this important, American Christians know that this is in the House of Representatives right now, and how many have we been equipped to understand how the provisions of it would affect relieving poverty, even though we've said that relieving poverty is important to us. Another negative example, in my opinion, is when we defend Christendom, and the Ten Commandments controversy seems to me to be primarily defending Christendom. Now, this morning I realized at my table, the lawyer who represented the judge in Alabama who was trying to, he was at my table this morning. So I'm sorry he's not here, he could give the other side. But Al Arison, my colleague, was speaking to a group of students, and it came up that, you know, they were very incensed about the Ten Commandments controversy. Can you have the Ten Commandments in a secular courtroom? And he said to them, well, how many of you are in favor of having the Ten Commandments in the courtroom? Everybody raised their hand. How many of you can recite the Ten Commandments to me right now? Nobody. Are we defending Christendom or are we spreading the gospel? And finally, we talked in the business world, you know, tent faking, not really caring about business, compared to engaging business would be to, for instance, engage in improving relationships and customer service in your work group. You know, or the MIT open courseware. What a wonderful example of engaging culture. And a positive example of, that I know of is a guy named David McHugh, who owns the McHugh Corporation. And he realized that Matthew 18:15-17, if you're familiar with that passage, is a conflict resolution passage. If you have an argument, you know, go to the person that you're in conflict with. And he actually has, in his company, by the way, his company makes guard materials to keep trolleys from messing up you know, supermarkets. So that's just a very mundane business. He actually has created this conflict resolution process that everybody in the corporation he teaches how to use. Now, he doesn't tell them it comes from Matthew 18. He waits until they ask, where did you get this idea? This really works. Now, that raised in me the question, are we tempted to abandon the slow, hard work of transforming workplaces? Because he's in there, you know, teaching people one by one how to engage in good conflict resolution from the Bible. But I think there's a temptation, and for example, I won't name this ministry, but a very famous American ministry a few years ago had a marketplace initiative, but it withered away, and now they have a cultural initiative consisting of lobbying for Christian issues and trying to get Christian material into the media. And I think they just got tired of how slow it is to transform one workplace at a time. A good example is Chuck Colson, in my opinion. He continued with Fellowship, which is, you know, trying to change one prison at a time, which I think is a workplace. What slow work. He did that for, 30, 40 years? Right up to the end, that was his main mission, even though he also engaged mass media. Barrett is a great example. 22 years to get a workplace plenary talk. Yeah. And another poor example would be me. I tried to leave the business world to become a pastor because I think primarily I got frustrated by how slow it is to try to change your own workplace. And then even after you've done it, you've only changed your small group. Now, another reflection I had is, are we creating an evangelism and discipleship divide? And I just kind of observed that evangelistically oriented Christians often seem to value culture primarily for access as an access medium to non-believers. Whereas discipleship-oriented Christians, and I have to confess I'm unbalanced in this direction, value culture primarily for business ethics, individual growth, or social action. And my question is just, you know, why is it so hard to come together? And I admire this today's generation of tent makers because they really seem to be at the forefront of bringing these together. And one of our tent makers, Stainer, you know, gave me this slide. Both are part of the Great Commission. If you think of the Great Commission as just evangelism, you're only thinking of the first part. Go to all nations and teach them and baptize them. But the second part of the Great Commission is teach them to observe all the things that I have commanded you, including the kind of social action, business ethics, you know, how to live as a Christian. And, you know, that's often called discipleship. They are both part of the Great Commission. And today, Rabbi Zacharias gave me a new word. He said the gospel message is proclamation and compassion. Yeah, so I almost like that word better than discipleship, because the purpose is not the individual disciple, but the compassion they show to the world. Another question that came up is, should we work with non-believers? There's not time to get into that. But let me point out that that's a question that we spend a lot of time on our project. And we have a section on in 2 Corinthians, the text is don't be yoked with unbelievers. What does that say about working with non-believers? And I'd love to get any reactions you might have if you go to that site and comment on it or send me an email. And then I wondered, how should Christ followers use wealth to influence culture? You know, we think of giving, which is of course hugely important, but what about the way we invest money or spend money? You know, fair trading is a way of spending money, I think, for Christ, for influencing culture. What about paying taxes? Should we feel differently about paying taxes or saving or buying insurance? Are there other ways that we use wealth to influence culture? And I feel ill-equipped to do other than raise the question. Although, again, our project has tried to engage this. You mentioned this, SAS, on an article called Provision and Wealth. In fact, we have a whole section on use of provision and wealth, and I'd love to get your feedback, especially on the resource mobilization. Finally, the talk that Rosalie made, Rosalie Vossel Ewell, if I can remember her name right, She said, proclaiming Jesus to influential people and institutions is not a mission strategy. We are not going through the elites to try to do trickle-down evangelism. God does not, what we need to say, she said, to the elites, is God does not need your power, influence, or money. Because as Paul pointed out, God is the source of all things. And I was very relieved to hear her say that we're kind of not engaging in evangelize the elites so that they can kind of force Christianity on everybody else. Instead, she said, I'm saying this, I guess, Christ's testimony is that God's salvation comes by sacrificing power, influence, wealth, and all else on the cross. This was one of the messages this morning. Christ died for the gospel. He didn't become a cultural elite. He didn't evangelize Herod. He died. And ultimately, Christ and then was raised by God. So God's our testimony is ultimately not gaining power and influence, but demonstrating the power of Christ's death and resurrection.